When one embarks on a career as a professional scholar, it is commonly spurred by a desire to make a significant contribution to society, through personal service such as medicine or law, or helping solve a vexing problem. We want to make a difference, we want to give back, we want to do something about X or Y. But somewhere along the way, perhaps beginning with one's dissertation or one's socialization in the academic field, we wind up narrowing the questions down to what is deemed feasible or empirically testable. And that socialization process channels our work from then on, dissuading us from getting back to answering the big questions that brought us to the field in the first place. So how can we restore the sense of wonder from our beginnings and get after the big questions again? My name is Tom Galvin, and these are my reflections on management. The specific inspiration for this episode is the recording that we did not too long ago that will become episode 57 of the Main Talking About Organizations program. And this is a discussion of Steve Kerr's famous article on the folly of rewarding A while hoping for B. And it perfectly captures the problem. Steve Kerr's article was originally published in a top-tier journal from the Academy of Management. That was really not an empirical study and is not the sort of an article that one would expect in a top-tier academic journal nowadays. As a matter of fact, that was one of the points we raised in our discussion was, this would not appear in Academy of Management now. It would more likely wind itself in Harvard Business Review or something else, something that has a little bit more of a practitioner focus. Because it was not built as a rigorous study of a phenomena. It was a presentation of a phenomena with a whole bunch of examples. And we also covered some counterpoints from other authors that said, hey, Steve Kerr's article is wrong. But then again, you look at, what do we consider a classic? One of the measures is an article's longevity and its usage, its continuous impact, people citing it. All through in many different fields. And Kerr's article is definitely one of them. So when I think about, say, reflecting on my own experience, recalling that as I talked back in my episode zero, I came into scholarship fairly late. And so unlike, say, a young scholar whose socialization process is really embedded with trying to figure out how are they going to get their career started, which is to get into constructing research studies and getting stuff published fairly quickly. Orientation is far more in with my job experience, with being a practitioner. My mindedness is toward practice more than scholarship. I lean heavily more towards relevance than rigor. And everybody, as I talked in a previous episode, everybody sort of falls in that spectrum somewhere. I mean, I talked about back in season one, episode six, on a spectrum between scholarly rigor and practical relevance that theories fall upon. But certainly what it did as I went into my doctoral program is I was always looking for answering a big question. And this became very apparent in one of the early research-oriented classes we have. Most doctoral programs, of course, devote time to writing seminars or readings classes or methods, all of the building blocks of good research. And it also includes understanding and learning about what it takes to get published. And we used a particular text, which is a very popular one. And that is one that talks about how you get into or identify your scholarly community and communicate with it. The metaphor that's used in this particular book, which I won't cite because by name because it's I'm not calling it out. This is just an example of the type of discussion about scholarly publication. Is imagine yourself at a conference or a social event. In which people who are like-minded are gathered in groups around the room, and you want to join a conversation. Well, in order to do so, you have to understand what it is that they're talking about and how they talk about it. How do they define terms? What are the things that they're interested in? It does leave one, if you abide by that metaphor, naturally, you can understand why, or you can understand the view that the academic community is compartmentalized. That being said, of course, you can also follow the same metaphor that, you know, there are some people that are walking around from group to group with a drink in their hand, and they're basically sort of bridging across communities. But never mind. I mean, you know, the takeaway was that if you want to be able to get published, then you've got to narrow down to exactly, you know, to matching the language and matching the common understanding of the community to which you're going to publish in, which arguably makes sense. But then in that same class, we had a little bit of an exercise. And the point of the exercise was to try to get us, you know, young students to express what it is that we're interested in the form of something that could readily be described as a research question. So we were basically given 45 seconds to explain our interests, you know, as if we were going to try to join one of these groups in this metaphoric conference. And I'll be honest, I rebelled against the task because it just doesn't mesh with the way that I think about things. And so rather than give a 45-second pitch on what I thought my interest would be in terms of research questions, I gave a 15-second pitch that was something more like this. My interest is in ensuring that the next generation of national security professionals who I teach are better prepared to assume positions of higher responsibility. End. That was it. And no, you're not going to be able to translate that into any research question. It's not intended to be. But that's my interest. And so then, you know, how I end up having to try to pursue that interest is very generalist. I mean, I am far more of the person who is going from conversation to conversation, skimming the surface across a whole range of literature streams and trying to pick and choose and, you know, identify what's going on and seeing across things, rather than trying to get myself in depth in one of these conversations. Because I know that in order to solve what it is that I'm interested in, there's no one answer. There's a lot of people who are looking at different aspects of that same problem that are well outside of any field that I'm studying. So, you know, I was in human and organizational learning. Well, you know, what I'm talking about is also higher education administration. It's also political science. It's international relations. It's a whole variety of academic fields that all seem to have some contribution to my answering the big question of how to make national security professional education better. So how do you do that? I mean, how do you do that? Go across such a wide range of fields in order to be able to keep a focus on what is the big question, the thing that, again, drew me into a doctoral program in the first place. So in a way, this is my problem, and let me talk about how I've been trying to solve it. And I want to go back to an episode, one of the first episodes that I did with the main Talking About Organizations podcast. This was episode 27, a discussion about Andrew Pettigrew's famous Journal of Management Studies article, which produced Pettigrew's Triangle. Many of us had fallen prey to the allure of simple solutions to complex problems of organizational change, and simple solutions coming in the form of very simplistic, process-oriented tools, such as reducing Kurt Levine's treatise about organizational change as unfreezing, moving, and refreezing. But coming out of Pettigrew's, the episode on Pettigrew, we discussed how the content of the change problem can influence the process that you use. And that certainly is the case with military organizations, that there are a lot of constraints to being able to use the common popular process models that, you know, just basically make the prescription just not really work. I had been left with a big question, knowing that the, you know, the Army in particular had written into its leadership doctrine, saying that leaders are expected to lead and manage change. And yet, some of the simple process models were things that were actually being written into the leadership texts that says that this is how you go about leading and managing change. Having gone through my doctoral program and understanding change perhaps with a little bit more depth, was left with a very big question. What can we do to prepare leaders to be able to lead and manage change in complex environments with significant constraints? So that was the big question I was asking. Then the opportunity came where I took over the leading change elective at my institution. And this was sort of like a prime opportunity to start looking at all of this broad range of organizational behavior, organizational development, political science, and especially a course that I took at George Washington University called Organizational Diagnosis, which was an absolutely tremendous course that provided us a chance to do field work and actually work through the problems that an organization had. So what I found, which I'm sure many of us have experienced, is that the answer to how you lead and manage change is going to be you're going to be picking and choosing aspects from a wide range of literature, looking for what best helps the manager address their problem. I had to be not just the one moving from conversation to conversation with the drink in my hand, but I had to figure out how to explain all of this wide range of knowledge and distill it down to a set of tools that were not too prescriptive, not like the process models, but essentially produced a line of questioning. Although I went down this path before I read this one book, I found that I had actually kind of stumbled on the solution in a way. There is a book that I recently read that just gave me this rather huge aha moment. And I believe it's Warren Berger's book, A More Beautiful Question. And their methodology of questionings is really wonderful when you think about it. What they do is they teach you to think about three different types of questions: why, what if, and how. In a lot of ways, that was what I was trying to do without necessarily having structured it exactly that way. But what I found to be a useful way of trying to help with addressing the big question was to break it up into little questions that can be put into practitioner language. And they happen to be, does the problem exist? A diagnostic step. And then instead of prescribing a diagnostic model as the solution, you use further why questions to think about what kind of information you need and then understand how other scholars had come to try to answer those questions, which thus produced those models, followed by what if. What if we solve the problem this way? Think about visioning, because one of the things I found in particular, everybody talks about, you know, you've got to have a good vision. Well, you know, a few episodes back, I talked about writing a vision statement's really hard. And part of the reason why it's really hard is because we try to cut corners and make it too superficial. We don't think about, you know, everything about what that vision statement means necessarily. And then, of course, there's the plan. You know, how are we going to do this? And of course, if you're in an organization where you're under constraints in terms of the control over your environment, you know, the how, you've got to be able to put the, you know, figure out the constraints. You may not be able to rely on the quick win scenario that a lot of change management literature relies upon. You might have to go about things a little bit differently to think about progress. Culture change works very differently. You can't try to plan culture change the same way that you approach adding a new capability to the organization. What I found to be useful, which kind of went into the monograph that I published recently through my institution's press, is an educational text, which is about leading and managing change, but doesn't provide the answers. And this is exactly in line with what Berger was suggesting. Instead of trying to find what the answers are, to say, this is the process, this is the way you go about it, this is what you expect to see, you know, the perfect sequence. It's a line of questioning which is designed to be iterative. And so we start with questions about basically identifying the problem statement. And there's a whole bunch of questions that are associated with that. You know, what is the problem? How do you figure out what the problem is? How do you understand what's causing the problem? Which allows those elements of Pettigrew's triangle, the content of the problem, the context to which it's in, and then the processes in which the organization ordinarily uses, and the interactions among those three, to emerge more naturally from the manager or from the organization looking at itself, as opposed to being force-fed down a particular path. It brought in all of these different literature streams without trying to make it look like a compendium of models, which was precisely what I was afraid of. I didn't want to try to just shove like 30 or 40 models in front of, you know, and say, okay, you pick and choose from here and you just sort of assemble it like a bunch of things. What I said was, okay, here is the question. Now, how had scholars tried to answer that question? And what perhaps can we draw from their look at that question and put it to use to solve your problem? So a question, one way to answer it. And I've run this, you know, the monograph was based on my running this course for several years and developing experiential exercises, all built around trying to keep focus on ultimately the big question. What is the problem you're trying to solve? How can we lead and manage change to solve the problem? It seems like the architecture of, you know, the why, the what if, and the how kind of questions, if we can kind of keep those sort of in the back of our minds, and we think about, you know, not just what it is that we're trying to study, the phenomena we are most interested in, if indeed we're looking at research questions, we also want to find ways to keep connected to those bigger questions that we're trying to solve. You know, obviously, at some point, we have to translate the detailed research questions into the bigger picture. And so I want to leave you with this last thought, and this kind of gets back to why Berger wrote A More Beautiful Question in the first place. And that's because in a lot of ways, you know, when we're talking about the big questions, these are the questions that bring us a sense of wonder, a spirit of adventure, just in general kind of motivate us, give us a sense of direction for what it is that we're doing. And that's kind of what we want to do, not just for ourselves, in order to further put purpose behind what we're researching, but also to help enable managers to be able to solve problems, because managers are under tremendous pressure. And there are many times in which they feel like they have to have the answer when they don't have the answer. And if we're trying to help the managers, we don't necessarily want to impress upon them that we think we have the answers when perhaps we don't. Perhaps we should just remind ourselves that of what it was that got us involved in this field in the first place. Remind ourselves of what are the big questions that we wanted to answer that should motivate us to continue our work and to engage with others. And perhaps we should rebel or distance ourselves from this culture of scholarly conversation that divides us into small groups, and perhaps find ways to get all of us thinking and interacting on an even higher level, driven by the big questions that we really want to answer. And that's all for now. The views expressed are my own and do not necessarily reflect those of the United States Army War College, the United States Army, or the Department of Defense. Thank you for listening, and have a great day.